The music's on, the disco ball has dropped, and it's time to get this party started. You're listening to episode 33 of Disco Trek, a Star Trek Discovery After Party podcast here on the Tricorder Transmissions Network. I'm your host, Heather Barker, and with me, as always, is my favorite Gorn, my favorite Jeff. Welcome, Jeff Hewlett. Nice to talk to you again.
Hi, everybody. I am back. Thank you for the welcome. I'm back in a heated house, thankfully. I've been without heat since Thursday of last week, so it's been a little cold here up in New Jersey, but I'm back amongst the warm people.
Thank goodness. I don't know how you gave me that bullying flu last week, but somehow...
you got the same flu I had, didn't you?
Somehow it took me out.
That thing was vicious.
Yeah. Oof. So we're here. We're ready to talk disco. Thanks for holding the fort down while I was gone last week. For those who aren't familiar with Disco Trek, we're a community-based Star Trek podcast focusing on each episode of Star Trek Discovery as they air. Tonight, we're discussing episode, 6, right? Mm-hmm. Not episode 4, which is what my notes say. That is wrong. The Sound of Thunder. With us to talk about the episode are two members of the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas convention group on Facebook, which is the exclusive gateway to gain admission onto the show. Our first guest is a returning guest. He was here last season on our very last episode of season one. He is Gregor Cameron. Gregor, welcome. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, good evening, Jeff. Good evening, Heather. Thanks for having me again. I've been a big Star Trek fan since I was around about 7 or 8 years old, and used to show the reruns of the original series on BBC Two. I used to run home from school and watch it on the BBC here in Edinburgh, and then got very excited when TNG came out and loved all the original series movies, and it's just really never stopped for me. Star Trek is something that comes into my life every day, to be honest. I'm a member of Starfleet International, and we have events here in Edinburgh. We have meetups, and we have away missions. We do away trips to Glasgow. We go to the Destination Star Trek in Birmingham. We're hopefully a number of us going to be in Vegas next August.
All right.
I'll have my camera again, so running about pestering everyone that's in a decent costume.
Awesome.
And just love all things Trek.
Yeah, definitely look us up if you go.
I missed it last year, unfortunately. I've been for a couple of years in a row, but last year I had a detached retina.
Oh, ouch.
A couple of weeks before the convention, so I wasn't allowed to fly, unfortunately.
Can't risk your eye for Star Trek. That's asking bit too much.
Absolutely not.
I'd used up all my transporter rations.
Well, we hope to see you this year. We're going to keep our fingers crossed. Our next guest is a new friend of ours. He is Rob Garrison. Rob, will you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. As I said, my name is Rob. I think maybe Gregor and I are similar aged because I also grew up watching reruns of the original series and remember being really excited when TNG started to air. Both my parents were original Trek fans who watched it in the 60s, and my family would buy the books, the novels, and Trek was kind of a real family time thing for us, and that has stayed with me all these years. And to this day, it's something that we can always talk about and have fun with. And now a big part of my Trek fan is a fellow podcast of yours called Star Trek The Next Conversation.
Nice.
Another one called Making It So, where they interview people who are behind the scenes in Trek. And which that, again, TNC has further inspired other podcasts like Geek and Son and Welcome to Geek Town. It's been a real big kind of part of my life in the last year. Really enjoy interacting with the other fans. And so I hope there could be some sort of cross fandom between these two podcasts. That's focusing on generation right now. They're Patreon. They're talking about disco a little bit. And I think there's a lot to be said for both series.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Awesome.
This is super cool. I think this is my first time in 6 years of podcasting where I've been, I don't want to say amongst my people, but amongst people who also grew up with TOS reruns in their youth. So I'm feeling very at home today.
Well, great. We're going to hop into our discussion of the episode in just a minute. But first, we have some housekeeping to do. As we mentioned, Disco Trek is community focused and evolved from our desire to give fans and our convention community a way to talk about Discovery. So if you'd like a chance to be on the podcast, make sure that you join the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas convention group on Facebook. Once you do that, keep an eye out for our posts every week with the Disco Trek image and information on the following week's recording time. We've generally been recording on Sundays, but it does change here and there, so you want to make sure to pay attention. Just comment on that post to be entered, and we use a random generator to pick the two winners on Saturday. Once you've been on the podcast, you can't come back for the same season, but there are ways to be a part of the discussion. We have a couple posts in the group. First, it's non-spoilers, and then we open it up to spoilers, so you can do stuff there. You can also go to our webpage and leave us a note. Jeff, do you remind everyone how to do that?
Oh, absolutely. So if you want to leave us a voicemail, the best way to do that is through our webpage at thetricordertransmissions.com. When you go there, you will see on the right-hand side of the page, there'll be a big box that says leave a voicemail. You can do that anytime, and we will get notified that you've left it, and we can play that on the air as well.
All right, so we can fast forward, I guess, to I'm pretty sure we had just announced our upgraded Patreon tiers. And along with that, we've had quite a bit of activity. So do you want to tell everyone,
what a week for Patreon for Tricorder. Oh, my goodness. Yes, we did announce our new tiers. I'm not going to go through all the benefits right now, but we have several tiers: transparent aluminum, trellium D, latinum, dilithium omega molecule, and harmonized omega molecule. So you can go to the website and see the different tier levels. You can get there by going to patreon.com/thetricordertransmissions or by visiting our website, thetricordertransmissions.com, and clicking the orange Patreon link in the upper right-hand corner. So we usually have our normal Patreon spiel so that we have everything that's available to all of our patrons, which includes unedited and early releases of a lot of our shows. They usually go live, usually the day they're recorded or the day after they're recorded, in an unedited form or in an early release form. That's available to all pledge levels, regardless of the amount. So if you sign up at any amount, you'll get that benefit. We also have Patreon exclusive buttons that we send out, along with a lot of other new benefits that are part of all of our tiers. There's way too many of them to list here right now. We'd be here half the night just listing all the really cool benefits. But the response to the new tiers has been amazing. So we have three new patrons, two of which are some of our Tricorder family: Jim Morehouse, host of Trek Ranks, Marina Kravchuk, host of Shore Leave, and Annika Dane, who's been a guest on some of our shows. They are our new patrons this week. Thank you guys so much for your contributions. And not only that, but we've had five of our Patreon family members raise their pledges with the new tier. So we want to say a quick thank you to all of them: Thad Haight, Rick Willimuth, Catherine Robinson, John Kerkorian, and Patrick Escudero. Thank you guys so much for raising your pledge levels. We appreciate all of your love and support for the network, and you are all enabling us to have our incredible parties at STLV and create all kinds of new swag for you guys. It's been a storm of new buttons and designs and things we're working on as giveaways, and all of our patrons who are at STLV will absolutely get all of those giveaways. So thank you all for your support. You know, we really, really appreciate it.
Yep, this is not shore leave, but there's 154 days till STLV.
That's true.
So we hope to see everyone there, and everyone who cannot, we hope to see you on one of our Patreon hangouts, which again are open to all of our patrons. That's something that we will never restrict to any specific tier. As long as you donate something, you get to hang out with your friends, because that's who we are here at Tricorder. So, Black Alert. It's time to talk about Discovery. If you have not watched The Sound of Thunder, why are you here? Go back, go watch the show, then come back here, because we're going to spoil a lot of stuff for you. Our show is a general discussion about the episode, but it is segmented into three parts. Drop the Record is where we talk about our opening remarks and reactions to the episode. Play a New Track is where we explore what we learn that's new about the Star Trek universe. And Spin It Again is our look back at standout moments, characters, themes, scenes, whatever you feel is worth a shout out. So let's go ahead and drop the record. This was, I think, another ultimate Saru episode. I think Saru is stealing the show at this point. So we had so much happen in this episode. I can't even. Rob, what did you think about The Sound of Thunder?
Really enjoyed the episode. Even the title, I don't know, struck me. Maybe it's because I like some recent covers of The Sound of Silence, or I think thinking of DC Thunderstruck, or I don't know. It's really great. But what can you say? I think you hit it before. It's a very Saru-centric. They tied in some plot points that we saw from A Short Trek, as well as just sort of his general character progression. And, you know, he had physical changes last time and then more physical changes. And then also, I think we saw some personality changes.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been the stress. I guess maybe some people have some different opinions about that. Could have been the stress of the situation, or this could be a new direction for his character. But, you know, in general, just love the show. It's not a negative thing. I'm kind of curious what other people think. I'm noticing the last couple episodes, there's a lot of slow monologuing.
Yeah.
Introduce it. And are we wasting time? I don't know. You know, it used to be old Trek, be, you know, Captain's Log, and they'd knock it out. And now, like, boy, they're really, like, pausing for dramatic effect and taking their time. And I don't know what I think of it. So I guess those are my thoughts. Not sure what anyone else has to say about that.
It's just something you observe. I've noticed it, too. For me, it's kind of the – they're doing so much in each of these episodes. So I'm a broken record. Like, I miss – 26 episodes of Star Trek, just because we got so much more and we didn't have to shove so much into each episode. But
do you think that's because of the cost? Like, they're putting so much money into the effects and everything that they have to break it down?
Could be.
Or not. Or is this just the...
I think it's just because there's so much with the story and what's going on. And I could do a whole other episode about like what works for me and what isn't working for me. But my struggle with these last few episodes has really been a lot with the pacing. Like Obel for Charon, I struggled with, because we would have these really intense action scenes and then we'd go over to Saru and Burnham for this slow pause. And I had trouble like staying in each of those scenes. Like I wound up feeling like the very emotional arc with Saru and Burnham where he's about to die. Like I got bored. Sorry, guys. It dragged out kind of long. And I knew that Saru was not going to die. So for me, like, I think it's a good point because I'm struggling with the balance. However, a lot of people are absolutely loving these episodes and it's not bothering them at all. I don't know, Gregor, have you noticed this? Has it done anything to your viewing experience?
Yeah. Said what you know about these long slow pauses and things like that. You know, this, you know, in the old days it was the captain's log and it was the exposition that set up the episode, and it seems to me that they're trying to use these prologues to set up an emotional tone.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that the stories don't always, they're not, you know, progressing the story visually or narratively all that successfully, and I have at times found this season a little bit frustration. I think it's had some great highs and it's had some lows. And I feel that this season's still trying to find its feet somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
That said, this episode was definitely, for me, the high point of the season so far. I thought it had elements of some of TNG at its best. I don't think it should be TNG or aspire to be TNG. I think it should stand on its own, but there were elements in there that I thought were TNG. I thought the stuff around the Prime Directive was great, because I think in this story, the prime directive was not binary. It wasn't a yes or no. You have two species, one which had warp capability, one which didn't. So there, you know, so how do you deal with a planet where you have that dichotomy? So I thought that was great. I would have liked to have seen a more TNG style conversation around that, rather than, what is typical of Discovery so far is when they have a big conversation, it's very brief, and then they make a big decision, and it has a huge impact on the universe going forward. But I thought that was great. I thought the location stuff looked fantastic. And yes, Saru, more Saru, give us more Saru. He is easily the most developed, most complex, most engaging character in the show, definitely. So yeah, I did enjoy this episode.
I think a lot of his last season felt kind of let down with Civis Pacem Parabellum, because that was, you know, heralded as the Saru episode. And while sure, it was a Saru episode, it wasn't quite what I think most of us were looking for. And this season has kind of answered that, because I feel like Saru, Tilly, and Michael Burnham are the new triad. Like, not that we need to have triads, but they seem to truly be the focus of all the characters in Discovery. I feel like they are getting the most development and focus. I hope that some of that moves over to Culber, who we got maybe, 5 minutes of in this episode, but 5 super powerful minutes. Jeff, what did you think about The Sound of Thunder?
Well, let me roll back real quick to some of the previous conversation. I think one of the things that has been bugging me quite a bit, especially this season, seems more pesky than the first season, is I think that everyone who's watching this show has watched the entire series. And I don't think we necessarily need the recaps at the beginning of these episodes over and over and over. Do we really need to see Culber die again? I think we all know. The recaps just seem so unnecessary. And, you know, they could use that couple of minutes, you know, for more content. Every time I start these episodes, I'm like, oh God, it's another 2 minute recap of stuff we've already seen. I think we all are familiar with it. So, but overall, I mean, this episode, like everyone has said, this one really was amazing. I was just blown away. I felt that this episode was much more focused than the last two. I kind of like when Discovery focuses on a specific, it's not all over the place. It doesn't feel like a clip show. It's focused on one specific thing. And I think this episode did a great job of that, just like episode 2 did. It focused on one specific thing. And, the Kelpian backstory was interesting. And I really wasn't expecting that script flip where, you know, the Kelpians were the predators. And you know, I thought that was really, really interesting. And of course, you know, I would be remiss. I mean, everybody's already mentioned it already, but I want to say that, you know, Saru in this episode, I am so excited about the possibilities that this character is going to have. And I felt a bit more connected with this one, specifically because I feel like Saru now has almost like a Spock-like challenge. You know, he's got a nature that's going to be developing within him that he's going to have to try to find a balance with between this possibly hunter predatory nature and his duty and his the things he wants to do in Starfleet. There's going to be a conflict in him. And I really, that's one thing I love about Star Trek, is the character building. And I think they really gave Saru a really interesting path forward. So we can see so much more of this. We saw little bits of it, and I'm sure here we go. Heather said this earlier. We're going to talk more about this as the episode goes on. I'm sure we will.
Nope. Let's talk about it now. Maybe we learned some new stuff about Saru here that people are going to bring up in the other segment. I don't care. Like, Saru, this is Saru's episode, really.
Yep.
So I don't have a problem focusing on what all happened with him. I mean, I don't want to interrupt you, so please go ahead and finish your thoughts.
Oh, so yeah, I was thinking a lot about, you know, where Saru is headed after watching this episode. And the thing that really strikes, that stuck out to me, is that he is the first evolved Kelpien to exist. And now obviously they have a whole planet full of them, but he doesn't have any sort of mentor or template to help him grow forward. It's all up to him. I think that that's going to be an interesting challenge for him to overcome, as it will be for all of the Kelpien people. Now, there's really no guidebook for this. I mean, it's ancient history. All of the evolved Kelpiens have been gone for a very long time, and none of them are familiar with, you know, what the ways used to be at this point, because they've all been, you know, brainwashed by the mm-hmm. Ba'ul. So, you know, I'm sure that we'll revisit the Kelpiens in, you know, a future episode, next season, the season after. I'm sure we're going to have to go back and check it out. But I like the fact that this was kind of seeded early on in the first season, where we learned, you know, the story of the Kelpiens as they exist today. So we kind of knew that eventually we were going to get there, and we were going to see this happen, and we were going to get back to the home planet and hopefully save the Kelpien people from that horrible way of life. But I think there's a lot of great possibilities here, and I love coming out of a Star Trek episode with a lot of food for thought, and that's mm-hmm. what this episode did for me.
Yeah, no, I think that's on point. Regardless of whether the episode worked or didn't work for someone, what I have seen is a vast amount of discussion, especially concerning General Order 1, and specifically like this genocide upon genocide, if you want to call it that. There are so many questions that are still out there for both the Kelpiens and the Ba'ul. And I really do hope that we get some more deep dives into that, like similar to what Gregor said. You know, it would have been nice to have had a more TNG approach or insight even with this episode for me. But regardless, like, people are talking about it, and even the writers. So we had Bo Young Kim and Erica LaPolt both said, you know, hey, if people are talking about it, then we've done our job. So yeah, we're definitely talking about it. I struggled with really understanding, you know, what was right, what was wrong. I don't think we got a definitive answer as to why the Kelpiens were killing the Ba'ul to begin with. We don't know if they were killing them for food. I don't know how you would eat a oily, creepy thing. I don't know.
It's like sushi.
So yeah. So like we don't quite have that. We have that the Ba'ul eventually, you know, started killing the Kelpiens, and looking at the two creatures, like, they look very similar. So it kind of makes, well, I'm not going to say it. There were some people that thought they might be the same, that like the Ba'ul were just going to be evolved Kelpiens. And while what we saw doesn't quite look like that exactly, I did notice that like Saru had his new teeth darts, or whatever we want to call them, which seemed to fire off
autonomously.
Yes, thank you. Autonomously, like without, like, I don't, it seemed just a very natural, instinctive. he didn't seem to be controlling it.
Right. It was like a flight or fight thing. Like,
right. And in those scenes, there was also a close up on the Ba'ul where it looked like he actually had the same type of thing. I don't know if, did you guys see that?
It looked like spikes on the back or something that kind
yeah.
of, you know, like a posturing thing that some animals have.
Yeah.
Quite tell. I think you're yeah. right. Most people thought they were just going to be a different form of the same species, and instead we saw something that just kind of came a little bit, for perspective wise, out of left field, it seemed like.
Right, as everyone wants to say, Armus is great 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 grand something.
How could you not, right? Yeah
But go ahead, Gregor.
Yeah, I thought the Ba'ul, actually, if you take away the, or the, you know, the black stuff or the squid ink, if you were going to eat them, I thought physically they were actually quite similar to the Kelpiens.
Mm-hmm.
Pointed out there was the you know, the sort of the teeth coming out where the fret ganglia used to be, but the, you know, the fingers, you know, had very long digits, just like Saru has. They were very, you know, very tall, very skinny, just like Doug Jones. And I believe it was Doug Jones' friend who was actually playing the bow. So I don't think we've actually seen them in their true form.
Yeah, no, I really hope that we do get to. The person that played the Baul was Javier Bolte. And yes, friend of Doug Jones, another character actor. A lot of people thought that maybe Doug Jones was playing it. And I don't know who's out there watching the Ready Room, which was the Facebook Live, you know, the new After Trek, the Facebook Live, which is now posted to CBS All Access. Eventually, Doug Jones did the one for this episode, of course, and talked about that originally they did want him to also play the Baul, but it was going to be so intensive for him just because learning even more dialogue and then having to go back and forth with the makeup was just way, way too much. So they got Javier to do it. But yeah, I definitely noticed that they still look very similar. I don't know. What do you guys think? Like, I feel like there's a conversation to be had about General Order 1 and violating the Prime Directive, and then not only doing that, but, you know, helping force an evolution, mm-hmm. which my issue with this, what it wasn't even about like the hurried ending that a lot of people had issues with. It felt like this got wrapped up too easily. Mine was that, like, the rest of the Kelpians had no idea this was going to happen and mm-hmm. just got thrown into this very painful Vahari. And I assume that they must sort of know, like, what Vahari is or is going to feel like. But this happens to all of them. And then they come out of it like, where am I, Ganglia? What's going on? And they don't even really get an explanation either.
Nope.
And now we have, you know, regardless of the question of genocide and who was killing who, now we don't get any follow-up with the Baul. So we're just going to assume that they are PO'd and angry. And here we are with Serana, I guess, and the rest of the Kelpians going to try to make peace out of this.
No, they left a lot of, massive unanswered questions that they could focus an entire series on, or at least a couple episodes, if you really wanted to dig into, you know, the sociology and all the, you know, political ramifications and physical of everything.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
An interesting thread on this is obviously, you know, Heather, your points are all well taken, and I agree with those. So I think another thing that we need to consider in this is the Red Angels part in all of this. So obviously, you know, the Red Angel does whatever the Red Angel does and disables the Baul's technology, which kind of enables, you know, the Kelpians to be on the quote unquote equal playing field. So whose decision really was it? I mean, obviously Saru made the decision and the Discovery crew made the decision to inflict, you know, Vahari on everybody. But I think the Red Angel played a much bigger part, because that even if the Red Angel hadn't showed up and Saru had still, you know, won the day, quote unquote, the Baul would still have been far technology superior, and they would have been able to easily wipe out all the Kelpians, evolved or no. So, you know, the Red Angel really pressed a reset button on all of that. And whatever is going to happen now from this point forward is thanks in large part to what the Red Angel did to, you know, level that technological playing field. So there's a couple of different factors at play.
So I guess I can pick up on that. Do you think that at the end of it, the Red Angel completely wiped out their tech?
Yeah.
Well, it wiped out the weapons at least.
Because I didn't get that either.
That's kind of I took away from it. They didn't really kind of glossed over it, but obviously all those, you know, the self-destructive mass genocide devices were all disabled. Whether or not they could fix them, they didn't say, but it looked like, you know, the Red Angel was making that decision to say, okay, this is, you know, I'm going to go ahead and do this. You know, whatever comes, you know, this is my decision. I'm doing this. And obviously there's kind of almost a cross between Star Trek and Quantum Leap in a way, right? Because, you know, the Red Angel's popping up and righting all these wrongs, but it's still an arbitrary decision, you know, made by an individual, you know, for better or for worse.
Yeah, but isn't the Red Angel sending the red flashes first, and then the Red Angel follows up? So the Red Angel would have sent the red flash to the Kelpian homeworld, mm-hmm. which Discovery goes and chases, and then Discovery interferes, forcing the situation of the Red Angel then having to come in and destroy the Biol's weapons. So did the Red Angel precipitate all those actions to get to that point first?
Yeah, that's a legit question. And you know, that was what I walked away from it with, is that the Red Angel has a projected outcome in mind. Because it seems to be that this entity, whatever it is, person in a mechanized suit, time traveler, what have you, we'll quote-unquote get into that more later in the episode. But it sure seems like there's an agenda there. And if this person is a time traveler, you know, they have historic data that they are obviously going back and trying to, make changes to history, and enlisting Discovery or co-opting Discovery to help them reach that end.
Yeah.
I have a couple thoughts if you guys
yeah, know. Go ahead.
I think what you guys are saying is all valid, that there was almost so much in this episode, and I don't think we're gonna see as much of it in the follow-up, that there's almost was too much in there for them to answer. But they're also kind of delving back into kind of like the whole issues of General Order One and even Saru's history, you know. So apparently 18 years, forgets the ship's name, where Lieutenant Georgiou was on, right, comes, deals with the Ba'ul, makes the agreement that Starfleet is not going to interfere, that was like stated in the episode. And so, but yet they still take a Kelpian off the planet. So they're violating General Order One there. And then we have, 18 years later, they come back to it, and then they're dealing with the issue. They force evolution on these people. And also then are, breaking the promise from before. There's all this stretching and changes and everything, kind of, all these past sins, sins is a little strong of a term, but basically everything is kind of cascading to the present day. So General Order One seems to work if it's like a nice clear cut situation. But I think we can look at TNG and all the other series is that there's definite times where it has to be stretched and changed, and things have to are not as black and white. And we're seeing all of that, except they tried to do it within 60 minutes, and it may be a little too much to deal with in 60 minutes.
Yeah. I'm so used to having not so much everything wrapped up in the pretty bow, but just a little bit more cohesiveness. Not finality. I can't think of the word that I need, but there's too many loose ends. And my difficulty is that I don't know that we're going to be satisfied with what happens. And that's where it kind of turns into this thing of, this is a serial television show. As our friend John Krikorian, I think of him when we talk about this, because he has said that, it's really difficult to judge an episode or talk about an episode as a standalone episode when they're a part of this overall serialized arc.
And right, it's like a chapter book.
Yeah, and I really do think that it's true, because we don't know what's coming, and I'm just going to be very honest here. I have found. I think Jeff, you said, or someone said earlier that we're still getting our footing. Maybe that was you, Gregor. Even though this season I think has been much more cohesive and centered and fluid than the first season, it still is, I think, really trying to find its footing overall. And I know that is controversial because everyone is just loving the season, which makes me incredibly happy. But I don't have confidence that we're going to get answers, that we're going to see things. And it's difficult for me because with our characters and character arcs and Culber's a really great example. We got very little of Culber in the first season. He got, he got killed and then wound up in the mycelial network. And now we have him back, and we got him back the last episode. We have him for 5 minutes in this episode. And my understanding from Wilson Cruz and Anthony Rapp is that, you know, this is going to play out. It is going to be fleshed out. We are going to get more than, you know, a 10-minute commentary on PTSD and then we move on. But I feel like almost the actors have a much better understanding of their characters and what their characters are going through than is getting translated in the final product on the show, if that makes sense. And so because of things like that, I worry that we're just not going to get a closure here or an explanation here. Like, when are we going to come back and visit them? I don't know. I'm just really frustrated.
I think maybe one of the things you're hitting on is because there is only so few episodes as opposed to the traditional 26 or so that we used to have. And like you mentioned, Anthony Rapp and Stamets, right? We've barely seen him this season, honestly. Mm-hmm. And the focus has maybe switched a little bit around. So I've been a little unsure, like, what is Stamets' job even on the ship? He's just kind of been hanging out. Does he have
a role going forward? Because there's no, you know, the mycelial drive's gone now, or the
right, sport yeah, drive. Exactly. Even with, you know, the character arc that we might see, like you said, Saru, like you were like, oh, we know he's not going to die. Do we know that? Or do we know that he's going to stick around, right? If their main character is Burnham and the pinnacle of a Starfleet officer is to be captain, then she has to eventually become first officer and then become captain. So where does Saru go?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder about these, you know, progressions in these characters.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big playground. And again, like we're barely halfway into the season. So there's still a lot to come. And I really do hope that we get to continue to see great things, but I just find that I still have lots of questions and, it's difficult hanging on to those and waiting, I guess. I don't know. Gregory, did you want to say something?
Yeah, maybe it's just in the way the story was told, and coming back to the, you know, the characters made the decision very quickly to accelerate the evolution of the Kelpians as a way of stopping the genocide and evening things up. And that, you know, that was, as far as they were concerned, that was the issue dealt with. But we, as the audience, were then left asking the questions.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe that's what's unsatisfying.
Yeah, well, because that's a big...
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, that's a big question, is that you have, you know, put the Ba'ul in a very difficult situation now. So, of course, they're not sitting there waiting to have peace with you. And I think, typically, we would get some kind of resolution, even if it was just a one note check-in with the Ba'ul, like, or, you know, just something at the end of that. I don't know.
You know, I think that we have to take a step back and realize that this is a different storytelling method from any Trek series we've seen before. Mm-hmm. You know, we have 2 and 3-parters in other series, but this is truly serial Trek. And one of the things, and I maybe I'm in the opposite camp here, but I was glad at the end of the episode to have questions, because I like to think about things and wonder where things are going to go. I don't necessarily always want everything completely wrapped up with a little bow. I thought that, you know, I came out of this episode satisfied with what happened in the episode and kind of happy that I had food for thought. So I don't know. It's a difficult balance to strike, because, you know, they're telling stories over, I mean, technically season one wasn't really ended, you know, it continued in season two directly. And so we're getting a multi-season arc that just keeps going and going and going. And theoretically this could happen throughout the entire run of Discovery. So we will get answers eventually, but I think we may need to shift our mindsets a little bit for this different type of storytelling.
I think that ultimately for me, I thought about this the past few weeks, just because if you're a patron and you listen to our unedited episodes and what I say after the podcast, you would know that, you know, I do think this is a really great season, but for me, like, New Eden was the pinnacle And though I think that the episodes following have been really great and are just feel a lot better overall than most of the first season, I'm still struggling to connect. And it's a personal thing. It's not a reflection of the show, but it's kind of like my own expectations. Like I keep waiting for another New Eden, for another episode to affect me in the way that mm-hmm. New Eden did, where I ended that. Like, I don't know, towards the end of the episode, I'm like, this is just a really phenomenal episode. Mm-hmm. And I haven't gotten back there yet.
That was the most quote unquote traditional Star Trek episode of Discovery so far, I think. You know, that's, I think that we're all so used to that. And, you know, we, all of us, whether or not we, you know, expressed it, kind of wanted a taste of that in Discovery. And we really got it with New Eden. That felt like, it felt like it could have been part of any Trek series. You know, it was a almost a fully self-contained episode that dealt a lot with social issues. And, you know, it felt very, almost TOS. I hate to say that because I don't want to, you know, throw it back to TOS, but it felt very TOS. And, you know, that it was kind of almost a break in the serial, overall serial storytelling arc. And it shows that we can have, quote unquote, traditional Trek in this new Trek model. So, I mean, I'm sure we'll get more like that in the future. But yeah, it's been an adjustment. I feel the same kind of way, Heather, that, you know, I don't feel like I'm connecting with Discovery the same way I connected with prior Trek series. That's not to say Discovery is not good Trek. I am enjoying it, but you know, it feels very much more difficult to completely immerse myself in it in the same way I immersed myself in previous Trek series. Though there are some really great threads that I have found some connection with. I mean, this Saru thread specifically was one of them.
Yeah, let's talk about this a little bit after the show. So we don't derail the entire thing talking about how we see Discovery. But let's go ahead. I do want to bring up Colbert again at some point, but I do want to move us along. So let's move over into Play a New Track, where we explore what we learn that's new about the Star Trek universe or that's just new to you. So, Gregor, what did you have on your list for this episode?
I thought the flip-flop with the Kelpians was interesting, from, you know, the whole of series one with the Fret Ganglia and, you know, Saru having to deal with his fighting his fear constantly, to suddenly finding out two episodes now that he, you know, when he lost his Fret Ganglia, that the Kelpians did evolve, and then finding out that they were actually the predators going back 2,000 years, which they found out from the sphere. Which the sphere featured quite a lot in the episode as well last night, even though it's gone now. Yeah. And I think we're going to see that a lot more. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. It's almost related to some of the things that we've been talking about, because they've now introduced the story arc with the Kelpians and the Ba'ul that we're now feeling a little bit dissatisfied with because of the ambiguity of the ending of the episode. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. And what else? Well, what else did we learn? Probably that the Red Angel was a female, looking at her.
It does look like a woman. I thought the reveal of the Red Angel was really outstanding in this episode. And once I got a better look, because I watched this like 4 times, so like I did also notice that, you know, she is a little, you know, shaped like a woman. I'll be surprised to see, like, it's a weird thing with the Red Angel, because part of me is kind of over it at this point, and the other part is really excited to find out what the heck or who the heck it is. Well, and have those answers.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that in A New Eden, that was probably the most intriguing thing about the Red Angel, when you find out that the Red Angel had transported these people from 200 years ago, 50,000 light years, to this planet to protect them from the Third World War. And then we've not, the Red Angel's been floating around, so to speak, in the last couple of episodes. But I felt, in The Sound of Thunder, that was the first time we've actually seen anything new from the Red Angel. And when you've seen Pike talking to Ash at the end of the episode with the information that Saru had passed on to him. about the tech suit. So that's the most it's progressed in about four episodes, Red Angel. So yeah, I guess that was new.
Well, and I think Rob had some thoughts about the Red Angel because he sent us a very intriguing photo that I had seen going around on Twitter. So, Rob, do you want to tell us a little bit about that and then talk about the Red Angel?
Well, I'm not on Twitter, so maybe these are some parallel thinking lines. I'm sure I wouldn't be the only person to notice it. The picture I shared, I actually went to the episodes and screenshot it. So we see the pylons of the Bau pylons. We saw it back in the short trek, but I didn't feel like it was a clear shot. I'd have to go rewatch that episode, the short trek with Saru. Mm-hmm. But in this episode, they show them very clear. And they are literally the preserver pylons, the preserver monoliths that are seen in the TOS episode, The Paradise Syndrome, just reversed. Mm-hmm. And that can't be an accident. Like, if they kind of look like them, then maybe. But they have the same indentations, the same shape at the base and the top. It is very clearly not just an homage to me. So I know there's a lot of speculation on the Red Angel. And so we have these rumors of the preservers, which was apparently some kind of alien species that literally preserved other cultures. Mm-hmm. Like Paradise Syndrome, it was a Native American like tribe or something. And they put them on this world so they could just be by themselves before they got wiped out. So that seems to be a very similar mission statement between the two. And again, I just can't see this as an accident.
My weird question though is then, like, does that mean that the Bau are the preservers, or that the preservers like maybe took this technology or just moved a Bau ship? Like,
right. Yeah. Shoot, who knows, right? preservers and TOS or anything like that. So it could be that the Red Angel is preserver or has this technology, or they're somewhat related maybe to the Iconians, or that since it's upside down, that when the technology is being used, it's in that configuration. And then when it's reversed, when we see it in TOS on the in the Native American colony, it's just a model. It's just a statue.
Yeah. You know,
active versus inactive. And that's a real speculation, kind of guesswork there. Anyway,
Yeah, just going back to the Paradise Syndrome, when it was the inverted from what we've just seen. Am I right in thinking that there was an asteroid heading towards the planet and it was built to deflect it?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So it was pointing that way, but the Bau came from underneath. They were below the surface of the water, weren't they?
Oh, that's interesting. I guess interesting. I like it.
No, it's a good theory. That's one thing that I was scratching my head about on this. In this, when you find out the quote unquote true backstory where the Kelpians were the predatory race and the Bau were the ones that were preyed on, it was never really explored how the Bau were able to develop that technology. You know, mm-hmm. being under that kind of oppression. I mean, they would have to have some incredible capabilities and develop them very, very quickly in order to completely wipe out a predatory race. I mean, it makes so much sense that an alien race could have come in and assisted them or given them the technology.
And this whatever race or, you know, organization or species that this Red Angel is a part of could have originally like intervened
mm-hmm.
and then realized that, oh no, they took it too far, right?
Yeah.
They took my guns. They didn't defend themselves. They started shooting people in the face.
Yep. No, it's true. And you got it. That's, you know, something I was thinking about. What could the resolution of this whole Red Angel storyline be like? And I think this kind of stuff could really feed into the conflict between, I mean, obviously we see like right now it feels like the Red Angel is really altruistic, but what if we, you know, how does that compare to Starfleet values? And what if Pike and the crew of Discovery finally track down the Red Angel? What is the moral choice that they have to make? Obviously, we're getting a setup of, you know, General Order 1 versus what the Red Angel is doing. I mean, we've had that tug of war so far a couple of times. Now that's the decision that they're going to have to face when they face down, you know, the Red Angel. That's kind of feeding into that whole thing for me.
So I didn't come up with this. I saw it in a Star Trek group I'm in. What do you guys think about the theory that the Red Angel is Commander Riker in his Ambu Jitsu armor from when he fought his dad?
I have not heard that one.
I think it's Kelvin Spock.
That was just a little joke, because it's an all red suit with a faceplate. And while Riker was not as slender as that Red Angel was, I thought it was pretty funny.
I don't want Kelvin Spock.
Is Kelvin Spock using red matter?
No. This is what I have seen. I have seen mention of the Preservers. I have seen mentions of the Iconians, which I thought was really good, especially since they're dominantly women or female or womenish, whatever.
We've only seen their technology.
Well, and supposedly Star Trek Online has them. And Star Trek Online is not canon. So again, like, there's all this weird mumbo jumbo, but I thought that Preservers, okay, that has some merit. Iconians, okay, yeah, that sounds like maybe. I've seen someone saying that it is future Michael Burnham.
That's just speculation, because you see it's a slender female. I think that's...
Yeah, yeah. And then our good friend, host of Weekly Trek and fill-in for Disco Trek, Alex Perry, has said it's, you know, maybe it's none of those. And it's something that is very unique to Discovery. And others have echoed that statement. And, I mean, ultimately, I hope that it is. There are times when, like, I like the little connections, and there are other times where it's like, no, I just want Discovery to really stand on its own and not have all these interlocking characters and themes and whatnot with other series. So regardless,
they haven't really to date. Like, they've done the Mirror Universe already, several species from like Next Gen and stuff. They're kind of making connections all over the place.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, she's Spock's sister. Like the show started off with a huge connection to TOS. So I would think it would be really cool if it's something completely unique. Regardless, I'm just really eager to know eventually what it is, who it is, and the intention behind it, and the intention and moving people specifically, because in New Eden, like, when we had the reveal of the Red Angel at the church at the very end, like, people were terrified. That doesn't give you a positive picture of this Red Angel. Like, if the Red Angel was walking in like, I'm going to save all your people, and felt benevolent, I don't think people would have had such a terrified reaction. Although maybe I'm wrong. If you see some giant glowy angel thing, maybe you're just automatically terrified.
I think you have to take the situation into account too. And the humans, they hadn't seen aliens prior to that. So I think any alien would be terrifying.
I don't know though.
Technology, and all of a sudden everything glows and then you're transported, you know.
That's a whole other thing. I tend to think that benevolent beings, you sense that benevolent energy. That's a whole other podcast. And that you're not automatically terrified, but who knows? Who knows? I don't know. But Rob, do you have anything to add for Play a New Track that you learned that's new about Star Trek or Discovery or anything?
Boy, shoot. We have kind of already talked about a lot of the things that I wrote down.
Okay.
I come from a military background, and I'm an intelligence analyst specifically. So this Section 31 stuff is interesting. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's interesting. They're calling Leland a captain, and yet Tyler is now an agent, not a lieutenant anymore. So I find it's interesting, you know, the structure that we're seeing of Section 31, like how they're kind of going about. I don't know. That jumped out at me.
Yeah. I thought this scene at the end with the two of them was interesting. And I'm finding, you know, again, we're not getting a lot of Ash right now. But someone I don't know who it was on Twitter, but I think it was today or yesterday mentioned that, you know, Ash seems so paranoid. And is this a product of, you know, everything that he's been through, especially in Point of Light and going from one end of the spectrum to the other? Oh, you've got a baby. Okay, bye, baby. You can't be with the baby. So is he untrusting? Whereas I see it as kind of just the intentional setup of having that one character who's the devil's advocate as part of this, not quite faith versus science thing here, but examining issues from all perspectives and kind of being that voice of Jeff, as you, I think you mentioned, like, is the Red Angel good or not? We don't quite know yet. Like, the Discovery crew seems to think that the Red Angel is benevolent. And now we've got Ash Tyler who's suggesting, you know, maybe it isn't. And I think that's a really important, I just think it's really important to highlight that because it's part of this overall discussion that we're having across this season.
You're right. Like, someone does, you know, that devil's advocate or that opposing viewpoint is good to have in kind of in any situation in life. Otherwise you just start pressing on and everyone doesn't see the possibilities of other things. So I like him being on the ship as like a representative Section 31. I just kind of want to know more about their organization and exactly what's going on with them. I kind of wish he'd cut his hair. I know that's really thing to say, but it just looks so unkempt in uniform. That's just my military side coming out.
It's his Klingon hair. If he's still Klingon, we don't know. We don't know if he's still identifying as Klingon or not.
And the last thing, if you go look back, I wrote down the timestamp 5105. He leaves his glass on the table and walks out of the mess hall. Tyler, your mama don't work here. You need to settle your own glasses and put it back in the replicator.
That's right, Ash Tyler. Pick up after yourself. Well, Jeff, what about you? What did you learn that's new about the Star Trek universe in this episode?
Well, I really enjoyed some of the Kelpian backstory. Getting to meet some of Saru's family, I mean, his sister, that was a really brilliantly played character. I really love the interaction between Saru and Sarana. That was really heartwarming. Something that Gregor had said before, I was really glad to find out that the sphere and the data they got from the sphere was not a MacGuffin. It wasn't just a wasted episode to kind of spin the wheels. Like, they're actually using that data for something. And something useful. So, you know, I'm sure we'll go back to that data again in future episodes. But I was kind of worried that, you know, that was going to be a one-off thing and, you know, the sphere died and they got data, whatever. But I'm glad that they're actually using that for something useful and getting some really good backstory on, you know, different races they encounter. And I have to wonder what happened to that data in the future. No, I'm just kidding. But did Discovery save it and they hoard it? They didn't share it with the rest of Starfleet? I'm just kidding. But no, that was really cool that they were able to pull all of that data out of the sphere's experience and use it to, you know, help the Kelpians to get back to, you know, their previous state. So that was really cool. I thought the theory about the Red Angel being a time traveler that was brought up in this is interesting. It opened up a lot of interesting threads. We've already talked a lot about the Red Angel, so I don't want to belabor it, but I kind of like that they're, you know, opening up the Red Angel a little bit more and giving us more things to think about. And Discovery's been really good about giving us these, you know, nuggets of information that spur us to make all these theories about what's coming down the road. So I think that's for a serial show, I think that's a really important thing to keep us all interested in talking amongst the community and on these podcasts about what this thing could be. So that I thought was really cool.
Well, I am really disappointed in all of you because I'm really happy because I actually have stuff that I can say, but why are we not talking about the fact that the transporter pad has a timer?
They've used that before.
Have they? I don't remember seeing the timer before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I feel really dumb now.
No, I think it's maybe not as been as focused as much, but there's been situations where, like, you know, Commander Riker gets on the thing, he sets the daily stands, and then it turns off. But I don't know, why didn't she turn the timer off?
But has it been shown, like, specifically as like a 60-second countdown type thing?
I can't recall. But they also, remember, they also have that automatic beamback technology that they never seem to use again. But the transporter obviously has functionality that they don't make wide use of.
Yeah, I don't know. I never really thought of it before seeing it as like being an actual timer. So having them like specifically show the little countdown clock made it something entirely different for me that I thought was super cool. So I guess I'm not disappointed in you guys since you brought it to my attention that it's not a thing that's new, but it was new to see that. So there.
Why didn't Burnham turn it off? Why didn't she turn the transporter off?
Well, I think she realized that, you know, Saru needed to do what he needed to do for himself and for his people. I think she respected him enough.
Still pointing a finger at him.
He appealed to her brother thing.
He did.
Like, yeah,
he played a personal role. Yeah, he played the personal role.
Yeah, he had the killer line.
And you have to have that there to move along the story. So I get that. I thought it was really cool. I totally appreciated at the very beginning of the episode and kind of throughout the sciencing with Burnham, Tilly, and Arium. And at one point when they're in there, Arium goes to transfer some of the data and like just like sticks her arm out. Like, I wonder how she's interfaced with all this. And we've kind of seen similar technology, like with Spock's coloring book, we'll call it, where you kind of pull that technology out to make the 3D hologram thing above it. But I thought it was kind of cool when Arium just like, phew, like that's me putting my arm out and sending data over to the screen.
It's more like a priority report.
I think it's good. I think it's quite refreshing that we're finally seeing some of the bridge crew doing stuff other than just pressing the buttons that they're told to press.
We got jelly buttons. Did we have a close up of the jelly buttons before? Because that was something else I noticed. I don't remember where it is in the episode, but like we get a nice close up on the little like TOS style jelly buttons when someone's pushing them. And I just squeed a little when I saw that because I'm weird. I think we've pretty much covered everything else I had to say in there. So we'll go ahead and move on to Spin It Again, which is our look back at standout moments, character scenes, anything you feel is worth a second glance. So who did I start with? Did I start with Gregor?
Sorry, Rob.
I started with Rob. All right. So we'll go back to Rob. Rob, what do you think deserves a special shout out?
Whew. Even though, as you mentioned, Colbert didn't get his, a lot of time, I feel like in the past, maybe other Trek series, something that happened last episode would have been forgotten and he would have been back to his normal self on duty and everything would have been good, but he is still struggling with this and he is recoiling from even people's, touching him and not really sure how to feel about everything. And I think we'll call it PTSD or whatever, we're going to go through. I like that they're really kind of treating this real and showing him react to it. And obviously I hope he gets over it and is able to, just be back on the crew and stuff. But I really thought it was a great like acting moment and a personal moment.
Yeah.
Although once again, we see that there's no patient confidentiality in sickbay. See this in all the Trek series. It's open bay. Everybody hears everybody's business.
Yeah.
And in medical stuff, I did. I thought it was good, nice, subtle. When the doctor was talking to Saru, the doctor noticed there was some physiological changes. And then we see those changes later on in the episode. The first time I missed that. And then I realized I'm setting it up and stuff. So I think good continuity there.
Yeah. So let's talk about Colbert. So Colbert is also on my Spin It Again. PTSD for sure. And I am really hoping, and I think that we will, based on what Wilson and Anthony have both said, I think that we are going to get a fair amount of time spent on Culver's PTSD. So he is in a brand new body, essentially. Same person, new body. And then there are questions of, well, then are you really the same person? Like, your scar is gone. Things that made you you aren't there anymore. And this entire time, Culver is just really, he's in this fog. And number one, like, this is a side of Culber that we did not see. I would say even when we saved him in Saints of Imperfection, or yeah, last week, right? Even when we saved him, you know, he was still kind of out of place and a bit chaotic. And now we're getting to see these effects. And holy cow, someone that went through this, that resonated with me so strongly. And I said something in a tweet somewhere to Wilson, because I wanted him to know that. And that, like, the fact that that could be done so very well, that it was almost triggering for me. But at the same time, it felt like such a, like, it felt safe. And I that's probably makes no sense at all. And I don't know how to better reiterate it. But instead of seeing something on TV that affects you in the way that really upsets you, like Culber's death, seeing somebody dealing with PTSD and dealing, you know, experiencing something that I have personally, this weird foggy disconnect, and just completely, like, knowing what that is and seeing that vulnerability, even though it could have been really upsetting for me, like, it wasn't. And I don't know. I don't know how to better express that. But that was so, so powerful. And I'm really, it's hard to see Culver this way, but I'm really looking forward to what Discovery does with this. Because I think that instead of getting the PTSD conversation with Ash Tyler, we're going to hopefully get it with Culber. Gregor, how did you feel about these minutes we spent with Dr. Culber?
I think the whole new body thing is a metaphor for the PTSD. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that his scar's gone. So on the outside, he looks the same person, but he's not the same person after the events that highlighted him, mm-hmm. Happened to him in the mycelial network. So I think that's the metaphor for PTSD. So just because of, you know, outwardly everything looks okay on the inside, clearly it isn't. I would have liked, you know, I think they were obviously laying the ground. I agree with everyone. Probably, you know, just a couple of minutes in sick bay with Culber and Stamets, you know, following on from the big, you know, last week, finding him alive, getting him home. So just to have 2 minutes with them this week does seem a little bit short, but I'm sure they will, you know, come into it more. Certainly given that Wilson Cruz's name is on the credits at the beginning as well. Yeah. I think there's a bit of a clue there that you know, they will sort of stem, they will come into it a bit more in future episodes. And, you know, unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be much more for Stamets to do now other than the Culber Stamets storyline, because he's certainly, you know, the mycelial network's gone. So, but yeah, I mean, I was very disappointed when they got rid of Culber, just when we were starting to get to know him, and the manner in which they killed him off, somewhat shock factor only, and not really doing much for the story other than to demonize the Ash Falk thing. So yeah, but I think it is good to see him back. Hopefully the PTSD stuff, they'll handle that as well as they did in the DS9 episode Paper Moon.
Man, such a good, yes, that's what I want. Like, it's like, again, it's, we reached a point where it's like, we can't, as Jeff said, and I've seen other people say, and I've seen the writer's room favorite a tweet that basically said, you know, it's, we got to stop comparing Discovery to all the other series, because it is its own stand, you know, it's its own entity. And as fans, I think it's so hard not to do that. But Yeah, like I definitely want something as satisfying and touching and just well done as It's Only a Paper Moon with Discovery. Like that would be amazing. Jeff, do you have thoughts about the Culber?
Well, you know, I thought that that moment in sickbay between Stamets and Culber was great. I thought it was very well acted, and I was very happy with that bit. But I think this is another symptom of the serial storytelling, that we're going to get bits and pieces littered throughout the entire season, and we're not going to get that full closure in one episode. So I'm trying to be patient with it. And another thing that really kind of stuck out to me about Culber in this is that he may be in a similar situation that Saru is in at this point, because we really don't know what the side effects are going to be, if he's going to actually wind up being his actual self again, or there's going to be some other developments that happen as a result of this new body that he now inhabits. So there could be a lot more to unpack in the future as he tries to assimilate back into his, you know, quote unquote, regular life. Because they said, well, he's fit for duty. He can get back to his regular life again. But can he? I mean, we're going to see what's going to happen with him over the next, you know, the course of the rest of the season and maybe even beyond. But I have a feeling that there's going to be some twists and turns that kind of get weaved into his storyline and being reborn again through the mycelial network, because, you know, he is now a unique being. You know, no one else in the Prime universe is a product of the mycelial network. So we have no idea what to expect from that. And I'm kind of interested to see what comes of it.
Well, but I would argue that Stamets is not necessarily a product of, but a connected to, and maybe that's what's going to help them. I mean, obviously in this episode, we see a disconnect for Culber with, you know, even the physical, you know, affectionate touch from Stamets, which hard to see, but that's the thing that happens, and I know this, and it resonates with me, and so it's powerful.
Shell shocked at that point, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it's when you're experiencing PTSD and you find yourself, you know, in these places, and again, Culber has just returned, so he's experiencing something very intense right now. Whereas for me, this is an elongated experience where it's not necessarily like every day, or definitely not every minute of every day. But when you have the way that PTSD affects you, like when you do have these moments, whether they're fear induced or anxiety induced or whatnot, like you do kind of withdraw, and someone's physical touch is not necessarily what you need or want. And even though Culber, you know, he may have, obviously he appreciated having Stamets there. Like you can see that in their interactions. But yeah, it's still a product of just not feeling comfortable with everything that's going on, and flat out saying, I don't feel like myself. And whether that can be explained by his nerves being brand new or whatever Dr. Pollard said, you know, that's to be seen. But I thought it was definitely very telling that the wise Master Saru said, perhaps in feeling less like you were, you are more like who you were meant to become. And so again, we basically have a line that not only covers what's happening with Culber, but what happens with Saru. And so, yeah, I think that's a great point, Jeff, is that the transformation alluded to in this episode is happening for both of these characters. And seems to happen to a lot of our Discovery characters. Like Tilly's gone through quite a transformation. Seems to be a theme that's going through. I will go back over. Jeff, what do you have that you'd like to shout out?
Well, you know, I think that just about everything that I had wanted to say in this episode, I've said. I'll just flip back to one standout moment that I didn't get to mention in this episode. It's around Saru, was the moment between Saru and Pike on the bridge where Burnham had to step in between them. I thought that was really telling about what Saru is going through and what he's going to go through and the changes that we're going to see in that character moving forward. We see a much bolder Saru. You know, I don't know if it would have escalated to the point of, you know, Saru taking a swing at Pike or them getting into some kind of altercation, but I thought that moment was really interesting. I thought that, you know, the acting by everyone involved was absolutely amazing in that scene. I watched it over and over again. I couldn't get enough of it. I really love how telling that small short bit was about what we could possibly be seeing from Saru and his struggles going forward.
I really agree with that. That was something that struck out too, that I was going to bring up. Wasn't sure if it was supposed to be because of the physical changes or just because of the very deep personal situation, and that, you know, he was going to, could be either one. I do know from my personal feeling, like when I saw the pilot with Saru, oh, I couldn't stand him because he seemed like kind of a coward. And then we saw change when we first come in Discovery and he's the first officer. He had matured and grown. And then there was that season or the episode in mid first season where he's acting captain and he starts by making this program on the computer and then eventually deletes it. He grows and matures. And then this season he has a little more of a sense of humor. And then now he's physically changed and now he's like a little more bold. And so there's been so much of a change in this character that we've seen that I think it's really interesting. And I wonder where they're going again, because I think that ultimately if Michael is going to become the captain, either Saru becomes captain next season or he goes back to his home world, or, you know, he has to evolve somewhere. He has to move forward up and out before Michael is going to move up.
And, you know, that's another thing that's a lingering thought for me with Saru is, you know, we don't necessarily know all the time what triggered the threat ganglia, but what triggers his little head daggers? Is that an automatic thing? Is it a response to, you know, aggression? Can he control it? We don't know. I mean, is that something that's going to pop up again in the future?
Like if someone agrees with him in a staff meeting, are they going to just get smacked?
Yeah. if something escalates like that situation with Pike did, are those things going to pop out? Because obviously we saw them pop out and shoot, and he didn't seem to have control over them. They just did it. So, you know, is that something that's going to happen again in the future?
Well, I mean, and I think that, you know, the ganglia happened on their own. It's a good question. I think that we're seeing a little bit back when we watched Siwis Pacem, Parabellum, and Pavo, and we saw Saru relieved of all the noises in his head from the music of the planet, and then feeling in control and feeling powerful. And that was exaggerated, but I think that was definitely a taste of what Saru is and who Kelpians are without being paralyzed by fear. And it's a very realistic thing. Like, guys, I put a sword in my hands. I, you know, now I, not that I feel invincible and I'm still very afraid of some things, but I feel like a really strong person to have survived a part of my life where I was extremely afraid. And so I get it. And I think that also with what we saw on the bridge, which I know was not in character for Saru and really took a lot of people out of the episode, I think that for this, you have to tap into everything that's going on inside of him emotionally, feeling disconnected, missing his people. I think that's been alluded to, and understanding like that everything was a lie and that now this is a situation where his people were oppressed and his people still are being oppressed, and he wants to do everything he can to help them. And so I think that all of that together kind of led to this very strong determination of wanting to help his people. I mean, he flat out challenges Pike and the crew about, you know, why would you listen to somebody who's oppressed my people? I think that there's, you know, again, there's a very big discussion to be had about what's happened with the Kelpians in the Ba'ul and who is oppressing who, or who was oppressing whom. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, the answer to genocide is never more genocide. But, you know, involving the Prime Directive, General Order 1, and everything else, there's just so much that can be said here.
Heather, I was curious, had you seen, you felt people, some people were taken out of the episode?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kind of get up in Pike's grill a little bit?
Yeah, because, you know, they've seen that growth. And you know, even myself, like, when this episode opened, I kind of thought, oh, wow, we're going to see this, you know, very confident, you know, in control, new kind of Saru, like, not a very emotional Saru. And we got an emotional Saru. And how could you not be emotional, you know, knowing the what is happening to your people now and really feeling helpless to be able to help them? Like,
I guess I am often critical when I see things that I don't feel are out of character. And this seems to seem like, oh, he's a little bellicose. This is okay. I get it. It seemed natural to me, I guess.
Yeah. But yeah, so my standout moment, we've mentioned Serana many times, and back in the short trek. So the short trek, The Brightest Star, and this episode were filmed at the same time, which makes a lot of sense. There was a bit of retconning with Georgiou's ship that she was serving as a lieutenant on. It was the Archimedes. And I think in the short trek, it said Shenzhou or something. So I don't know. Something happened there. But regardless, I really liked Serana in the short trek. And I was excited because I knew we were going to get to see more of her. I think she is an absolutely beautiful character. But what stood out the most for me, and what really was the high point of this episode for me, was her reunion with Saru and her introduction to Michael Burnham. That moment of first contact, I think, was just so beautifully done. That the fact that she, you know, there was no fear. It was just fascination. And I love, like, I love that Burnham, you know, pulls out the universal translator, or pulls out her communicator to utilize that. And
she was
that,
scooping
up. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, she wants to, yeah, I might have done the same thing. You never know. Like, what if he didn't know who Serana was, and Serana was a crazy priest? You never know. But I loved that Serana comes over, and it looks like she's gonna go take the communicator, but she reaches for Michael's hand. And, you know, here we have this message, which, when you look at the metaphor talking about genocide and even immigration and asylum that's happening with Saru, Serana, I don't have the exact quote, but, you know, she says something like, so different, but so alike. And I mean, if that ain't Star Trek, I don't know what is. But for me, I think that was the most beautiful first contact scene that I've seen in Star Trek. I know that's a big statement. It's just my own. I thought it was really amazing. And so, yeah, Hannah Spear played Serana, and commendation to her. I thought she did an amazing job, and I hope that we do get to see her again.
It was really touching, I have to agree. I have only one sibling, which is a sister, and I've been apart from her a lot of times, and I feel like I really kind of connected on that level. I completely guessed that she was going to be the priest. That seemed a little obvious that she was going to be. And while I wanted to ask this question to everybody, she's obviously a leader, and she's going to go back and she's going to help people. But also, if at the end of the show, Saru went back to help lead his people, that would not have surprised me at all, considering he's got like the technological and the knowledge of the world and the galaxy at large. I was actually kind of surprised. Or I don't want to say. I wouldn't have been surprised if he was the one to go back and take that leadership spot to help protect from the Ba'ul potentially retaliating. Again, not that she can't do it, because it seems like she's going to probably be the one to kind of guide her people and stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like they might need somebody who knows how the galaxy works.
Maybe we'll see that. I mean, I would be okay with that. I would love to see Captain Saru outside of the one-shot comic that's supposed to be coming out at some point. Like, I am fully on board with Captain Saru over Captain Burnham. No offense to our dear Michael, but I just
through season 3, Captain Burnham season 4.
Yeah, I want to see that first through. I do. So I would be okay with that if that's eventually where he ends up. I like that. What do you guys think, Jeff?
I think I agree. I think that Burnham not being a captain is a bit more impactful than her being a captain. I think Saru is obviously logically next in line. Obviously, but remember, Discovery was supposed to be picking up a new captain. Mm-hmm. So we don't know where this is going to go. You know, what's going to happen in the aftermath of, you know, Pike temporarily taking over. You know, we don't know what's going to happen the rest of the arc. I mean, maybe there's a situation where, you know, Saru is now better qualified to become the captain of Discovery. Who knows? I would love to see Saru and the first alien captain. I mean, it seems like a great place for Discovery to go. I mean, previous Trek shows have put different people, different demographics in the captain's chair, and we haven't had an alien captain yet. So it seems like a great direction.
Gregor, what do you think?
Yeah, Captain Saru, definitely. I think that we should have a whole series dedicated to Captain Saru. But coming back to your point, Heller, about the meeting with his sister, I thought it was really well played, and I liked the fact that she was both angry and, you know, delighted to see him as well. I have a younger sister myself, so I could completely relate to that. And yeah, I do think it's about time we had an alien captain as well. In all seriousness, and I think he is the natural choice. I'm not sure how, given that they were on their way to Vulcan to pick up their captain, and then the episode ended with Burnham saying, "I need to go to Vulcan." I don't know how that's going to play out next week. But yeah, I mean, for me, Saru is the natural choice to go as captain. I think Burnham's got a long way to go, given her history of mutiny, to be a captain. I think that couldn't be swept under the carpet quite as easily as maybe they would like to. But yeah, that I thought it was great. And in terms of one of my highlights, going back to the Vulcan hello and the mutiny scene with Burnham and Sinju, Giorgio and Saru, we've seen the exact mirror opposite of that played out in this episode, I felt. When Saru was quite insubordinate to Pike, and Burnham came over and used her experience to calm that situation down. Yeah. I thought that spoke volumes for the change in Saru and Burnham's relationship compared to what we've seen in the Giorgio Burnham Saru mutiny. I thought it was a very different dynamic.
If I can add to that, that scene in particular, like you said, Michael was the one who stood up, but I really loved that the rest of the bridge crew there, they did some great background acting, and they were kind of like, they were all noticing and like, this is out of character. And then you even see Lieutenant Reese, the security guy, he kind of stands up and he's getting ready to do something. He's not sure when Michael actually steps in. I liked the supporting characters in that scene.
Yeah. That's really been one of the highlights of the whole season for me, is getting to see the bridge crew fleshed out more and participating and getting more screen time. I just need to get some real character development in there at some point.
Well, definitely this is like a difference of the series, whereas traditionally it's an ensemble show with the captain as the lead, and they divvy up the episodes between the main characters. That's not what this show is.
Yep.
It's not the captain as the lead. It's a few other characters making the show. And like you said, first season, they barely had lines other than yes, sir, no, ma'am, whatever. And so I'm always excited. I'm a big fan of Detmer myself. Want to know what's more there. I'm really curious what Lieutenant Arium's position is even on the ship. Lieutenant Commander is on the ship. I don't know what her job is. I'd like to know, because I like that structure kind of stuff, you know, like she's working with Tilly, but Tilly kind of seems to be in charge. I don't know if that's just because she has more lines, But yeah, I'm excited to learn that kind of stuff. And again, it's not the point of the show. It's just me personally.
Yep. Well, I think that's good. Well, I am excited to see where we go. We're going to Vulcan, or we're going somewhere. I guess we're going to Vulcan next week, and it looks like we're finally going to get to see a familiar dude who we all know. Yep.
I think they're teasing us still. I predict Spock shows up at the end of season 4.
No.
I'm just teasing. I just feel like they've been dangling this carrot for a little while.
They have. I think
they've dangled more than Spock, because we've only had number one very briefly, and then all the hype before season 2 started, there was quite a lot around the casting of number one. So I think we are going to see number one. I think we are going to see the new captain very soon. And I think we're going to see a joint Enterprise Discovery mission with Pike back at the helm of the Enterprise.
Interesting.
I hope so. And if that's the case, then I want to see Chief Garrison. I want to see Lieutenant Jose Tyler. I hope we see all of them. I'd completely forgotten what Jeff said, that there was originally a captain on deck to take over. And I wonder if poor Captain Smithjan Smythe, or whoever, is just sitting there somewhere, wondering where everybody is.
So we're about midway. So we've still got so far to go. So much more Star Trek to talk about. But let's go ahead and go around and tell everyone how to find us on social medias, if you'd like to be found on social medias. Gregor, where can we find you?
Yeah, I could be found on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. On Facebook, it's just Gregor Cameron. On Twitter, it's at @CrabbitGinger. And I can never remember my Instagram Addy, but if you find me on Facebook, I'm sure you can add me on Instagram as well. And I like to post lots of pictures that I take at the conventions.
Very, very cool. Rob, what about you? Can we find you out in the social media verse?
Well, I do have Facebook, like most people. I guess I prefer that more for family and friends. I don't have any of the other social media systems, so I guess I want to just take this time to once again plug the podcast, Star Trek The Next Conversation.
Excellent. And we can find you in the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas convention group.
Absolutely. I love to chat with people in the group and get to know everyone there.
Awesome. Jeff, do you still exist on the social medias?
No. Not at all. You can find me occasionally in the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas Convention group, and I am Warp Factor Jeff on Twitter. Mention me, and I'll be happy to respond. I don't check Twitter that often, but I do get mention notifications, so if you mention me, I'll be able to pop on and talk back.
I feel like this is Jeff's new, like, you know, some of the bands that, like, they sing stuff and they just kind of some of the words, because that's totally what you just did.
Yeah, it is kind of what I just did. Yeah.
All right. Well, I am LLA Posper on Twitter. I have another account that I do spoilery treats. Well, they could be treats, tweets or treats. Other Discovery episodes, I needed somewhere to spoil stuff. I won't do that on LLA Posper. I will do that over at Oh My Starships. I am in the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas group on Facebook. So find me somewhere there. We are at @Disco_Trek on Twitter. Our network is at Tricorder Show. We are the tricordertransmissions.com. Go to our Patreon, patreon.com/thetricordertransmissions. Check out our new tiers and all of the new perks. Come join, be a part of our family. We are happy to have anyone, whether you donate $1 or $25, which I just have to say, $25 gets you some really good stuff these days. Like, the tiers are worth it now. But regardless, we want everybody to just be a part of our Tricorder tribe. And so in the meantime, We'll see you next week for another great slice of galaxy pie. Live long and prosper.